Virginia Festival of the Book is coming up March the 20th through the 24th. And during that time, there is at City Council Chambers a panel discussion discussing, of all things, flora of the Western Hemisphere. Now, you may not know a lot about that, but I'll bet you that you know about the Southern Exposure Seed Exchange. That's a company that I think we all became familiar with it going to the Heritage Harvest Festival and learning about heirloom seeds for tomatoes and other vegetables. Well, the original owner of Southern Seed Exchange and now the author of a very interesting book entitled Bush Medicine of the Bahamas, a cross-cultural perspective from San Salvador Island, including pharmacology and oral histories. Whew, that's a mouthful. The author, Jeff McCormick, is in the studio with us. Hi.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be here. thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Let's start back a little bit. The first time, as I said, that I ever heard of a seed exchange, not just the name of a company, but an idea, was going up to what is now Montaldo when they had the Heritage Harvest Festival. Been going ever since and tasting, I don't know, 20 or 30 different tomatoes
yes.
every year. So, but you've been doing this forever.
The company started in 1983.
Wow.
And actually, it began as a seed exchange in Nelson County. People would get together once a year and trade seeds and play music and bring food and so forth. And a friend of mine, David Vaya, had brought what are called potato onions there. It's a little unusual name. Many people haven't heard of it, but it's a type of perennial onion that lasts up to 2 years in storage, the small sets. And I was so impressed with this that I ended up writing an article for Organic Gardening and shortly thereafter found myself in the seed business.
And even though you sold the company, you're still involved in seeds.
Yes.
Like you'll never get it out of your system.
That's right. I seem to be genetically unable to walk by a I can't walk by a plant without collecting seeds. I don't know.
Whatever
now,
that is.
Do you plant all of these at your house or do you just do the seeds?
Well, we planted in the beginning, we planted a lot in our house. And actually, one of my first employees was a triathlete who we didn't have a rototiller. So she would turn over all the raised beds.
Wow.
And we have about 40 of them. It was great exercise for her.
I bet it was. Wow, it's hard to find a triathlete to do that.
It is.
Hard to find a teenager to do that, let alone.
We
should be very grateful to you because we've got these local heritage tomatoes and other vegetable seeds due to the work of you and people who have followed along in your footsteps. Otherwise, we'd be eating those plastic tomatoes from the supermarket.
Right. Well, actually, I'd like to go back just a little bit. We started out growing a lot of the seeds at our house, but then we soon realized that we just couldn't handle the demand for it. So then we started getting growers in different areas of the country. So we had growers from Florida to California helping to grow some of these seeds. And meanwhile, a lot of people were sending in seeds by mail along with the stories behind the seeds. And so one of the things that I was very interested in particularly is documenting the stories behind the seeds because it's not only saving the seeds, but it's also sort of saving the essence or sort of spiritual underpinnings of
vegetable farming.
Right. And there was some interesting, we had a lettuce that went back, actually, it's still in the catalog, goes back to the 1700s.
Wow. That's amazing that the seeds are still alive and viable and active for something that goes back that far.
Yes, and it speaks to the dedication of the people who saved those seeds. A lot of people don't know it, but actually seeds used to be passed down as part of the dowry, particularly in southern states.
I did not know.
Oh, yeah. Isn't
all right,
that something?
Let me ask this. How, over the years, like from the 1700s, how can you preserve a pure seed? Because, I mean, just with natural variations, with bees flying and pollinating and how do you maintain the original genetic component of the original seed?
Yeah, that's a great question. As it turns out, lettuce tends to be self-pollinated. So you don't, you can't grow two varieties next to each other and expect them to be pure.
Because they'll cross-pollinate.
They can cross-pollinate.
But they're self-pollinating, like you said.
They're primarily self-pollinating, right. But they will cross. So we have to keep them certain distances apart, which are called isolation distances.
Wow.
But others, like squash, may require, it depends on what you're using the seed for, maybe a quarter of a mile, sometimes up to a mile separation between the varieties to keep them pure. And so that's one of the reasons why we had to quickly rely on growers in different areas of the country, because we just...
We ran out
of space, just didn't have the space to keep the purity. So
right, it just makes you want to dig into the garden, which is such a good topic today because we're all so grouchy.
Listen, the snow doesn't make me happy. There's not a lot of stuff growing.
No power.
Power to snow's all right. It's the no power thing.
No power.
So let me ask you this. You always, whenever you get seeds, whenever I get seeds, not the pure kind, the blah, 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 but when I go to the Lowe's or the hardware store or whatever, I'm in the grocery store and you see some seeds, you're like, ooh, I'm going to try this. Mm-hmm. It always says packaged for the 2013 seed. Do seeds go bad?
Well, yes, actually, that's another interesting question. Yes, they will go bad. You can keep a lot of seeds for anywhere from roughly 3 to 5 years if the seeds are stored dry and placed in a airtight container like a mason jar in the back of your refrigerator, but it needs to be dry before you store them. But what a lot of people don't know is that when they buy those seeds packed for, say, this year, they may have been grown several years ago. And there's a good reason for that, is it's better to grow a bunch of seeds so you don't have to
deal
with those same isolation distance requirements.
Gotcha.
So
that's fascinating.
A lot of people don't realize that you can easily save your own seeds if you don't plant them all from year to year.
Put them in a mason jar, put them back in the refrigerator.
Put them back in the refrigerator. Ideally, it's best to make sure that to store them when your house is air conditioned or during the heating season, and then put them in the mason jar. But if you do it on a hot, humid summer day, then there's going to be a lot of moisture in those seeds. They're not going to last as
long. No, they'll get mold on them.
I just remembered this. It was probably, it was 10 or 15 years ago, probably when I first heard of it, I guess, and I hadn't thought of it since then. They started, and I want to say it was in some cave out in Utah or something, collecting, almost like Noah, all these seeds in case the world ended, we would have. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's the Svalbard Seed Bank.
That's it.
In, I believe it's Norway.
Okay, maybe I was all off on that, but that's kind of what it was the Noah's Ark kind of theory of we need to get these in case the zombie apocalypse happens and they eat all the stuff, we can go replant.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are other issues as well, as some of the multinational corporations are buying up a lot of the seed companies, particularly problems with Monsanto saying you can't save your own seed, and have taken farmers to court.
They sort of think they own every seed ever planted.
Yes, and it's a little scary.
Yeah, it is.
And so actually, part of the purpose of my informational website, Saving Our Seeds, is to give people the tools to grow their own seed and to save it. So I wrote 7 manuals for the USDA. I had a research grant from the USDA to produce these organic seed production manuals. And so you can go to my website, savingourseeds.org, and download the 7 publications that I wrote. And you can also download other publications that that are also on the site as well.
To Jeff McCormick, who we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, now we're going to talk about your most recent publication. I'm going to shorten it, Bush Medicine of the Bahamas, and we're going to find out what you were doing down there in the Bahamas and what did you bring back.
And for medicinal purposes, obviously.
Right.
WIND Morning News Time, 947.
All right, we're talking to Jeffrey McCormick, and something I just learned, another thing about Jeffrey McCormick in the break that he's doing stink bug research.
Are you really?
And yes, we can't even get into that, or we're not going to get to your book. Jeffrey will be appearing at City Council Chambers as part of Festival of the Book Wednesday, March the 30th.
This may be the most interesting thing that happened in City Council Chambers in quite some time. I had to get that in there. I'm
really?
Sorry.
Okay. Now, we know Jeffrey from his Southern Exposure Seed Exchange history, but let's talk about this book, Bush Medicine of the Bahamas. I'm going to stop right there. It has two or three subtitles. What made you go to the Bahamas to do some research, and what part of the Bahamas did you do that research in?
Well, I've actually had a long time interest in medicinal plants, and particularly the ethnobotanists who traveled to the Amazon to learn about the different plants that were used. But what really started the project is that my wife and I decided to take a tropical marine ecology course in the Bahamas given through Piedmont Virginia Community College. So we went there, and on the last day of the trip, one of the instructors had arranged for a bush medicine tour with a then 73-year-old man who was very well known for his knowledge of bush medicine. And so at the end of that hour and a half field trip, I was just astounded. And so I asked him, who's learning this? What are, and he said, he has 12 children who he calls a bunch of bananas. He said, said that none of them are really that interested in it, and some of the medicine is dying out because when the young people get sick, they sometimes go to the clinic, whereas the older generation goes into the bush and boils up plants for medicine. So,
and that's all it took, and then you were on
so
it.
Then I was on it, and I came
like
back.
Like a stink bug. You were just all over it, right?
Just all over it. And came back, wrote up a grant. I hadn't written a grant proposal and several decades, and fortunately it was funded originally for 1 year, and then it expanded into a four-year project. It just kept getting bigger and bigger, and so ended up with this nearly 400-page book, and it also is full of oral histories.
That's great. See, and, that's wonderful.
And I really wanted to bring the book alive and sort of have a soul to it rather than a sort of a dry list of recipes for medicinal plants.
Which to me are fascinating anyway. Mm-hmm. Where but, were you in the Bahamas?
It was in San Salvador Island. It's a very small island, only 6 by 12 miles. So it's quite small, and there were virtually no paved roads prior to 1950. So it was very isolated, and for that reason, a lot of the traditional medicine was not influenced by modern medicine.
So give us an example of one of the or two of the recipes or mm-hmm. what's Please. There that isn't here.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I'll give you one of both. One is periwinkle, which a lot of people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
They use it to treat high blood pressure. It turns out in the periwinkle has a couple compounds that are used in this country to use treat various forms of cancer. It has over 150 pharmacologically active substances in the plant, and it also improves your cholesterol. So that's one example that might be more familiar. But the one that was most fascinating to me was this treatment for tuberculosis given by the grandparents of this, one of the interviewees. And it consisted of 7 plants plus a cross of iron in the bottom of the pot. And I thought, that cross of iron, I wonder if it had a spiritual significance to it. But no, I used to teach microbiology, and I remembered that when some organisms and pathogens invade the body, they try to get the iron away from the host, which is what the tuberculosis does. And so, but too much iron is toxic to this bacteria. Uh-huh. So she said it had to be rusty iron, and that makes sense because it's soluble and it tends to shut down the bacteria. And then I can't discuss the other, all 7 plants, but one of the plants, cough vine, it inhibits that bacteria and also used in India to inhibit leprosy, which is the bacterium, which is related to
this, is amazingly fascinating. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We really are.
Oh, well, you're just going to have to show up at City Council on Wednesday, March the 20th at 4
o'clock. We would love for you to come back and talk to us.
And we want to hear more about it. We'll talk to you again, I hope.
Wonderful.